Hi, I'm John Patrick. I'm an alcoholic. I want to thank Susan for asking me to be here tonight, and I want to thank her and Chuck for their great support throughout the years I've known them, really, and for the great many people that I know here in this room. So I'll stick to the format of what it was like, what happened, and what it's like today. First of all, it really is for me to stand here tonight in this room and face everybody out here. It's really a spiritual experience for me. It may sound hokey to you and things like that, but from where I come from, it's amazing for me to stand here clean and sober tonight. I was born in New York City. My mother and father both come from Ireland. We grew up in a household where my father was a periodic violent alcoholic, and my mother never drank, and she was, it was a small tenement in New York. There wasn't too many rooms in the house, and what one person did overflowed on everybody else. My father worked for a brewery in Brooklyn, Schaefer's Brewery on Kent Avenue near the Brooklyn Navy Yard, and part of his job was delivering kegs of beer to the bars in New York City. And ways that the bar owners and bartenders at that time would more or less thank their guys for delivering the kegs of beer, with to give them a shot in the beer. And also working for a brewery, it was like part of the public relations for them to drink. So he, being an alcoholic, it was very hard for him, I imagine, going in and knowing that if he took the drink, he would be off and weeks of disaster happened. And for him to fight that urge must have been really hard. I never realized that growing up. In fact, I never liked the guy. And we never talked, and I didn't like anybody in my family, really. They were kind of an embarrassment. I grew up in a part of New York, was a mixed neighborhood. They spoke with a brogue. And plus, he was a falling down drunk when he was drinking. So what happened is, as a kid growing up, we went through this turmoil. Like, if my father wasn't home past a certain hour, we knew as kids growing up that there was going to be all hell to pay, and everybody would scatter. And then we'd hear the door, the key in the door, and all of that, and he'd be on a rampage for 3 or 4 days, and then after that, he'd be cleaned up, I guess, or he'd be not drinking, and nobody would say anything about what was going on. Come Sunday, we were polished up and dressed up and led off to church, and nobody ever talked about all the craziness that was going on in the house. As kids, we were taught to just keep your mouth shut in the street, don't say nothing, you know, say your prayers and all that other good stuff growing up, and go to school and that's it, keep quiet. But I guess I was kind of rebellious as a kid growing up. As a kid, I was stood up in front of my mother a lot and had to raise my hand, you know. You're just like your father. Don't ever drink when you get older, you know, and all of that. And I kind of didn't like that, because to me, my father was a monster, and I didn't like anybody to, my mother especially, to tell me that I was just like him, because I seen him abuse her a lot, and I didn't have that feelings towards her. But a lot of times when the insanity took place in the house and she left with the other kids, I was always left behind because, as she said, I was just like him. So then another part, I thought it was like part of my growing up. But when I reached a certain age, it was said that when your sons grow up, they're going to take care of you and this and that. So I thought it was my duty or something when I reached a certain age that I was going to have to stop my father from drinking and stop him from ruling the house with violence. So that came about when I was about 14. He was drunk and falling down, and I was kind of a cocky, wild kid. And we got into a fight. And what happened was I took advantage of a drunken older man, and he was marked up the next day in the house. And it was a sad situation because everybody then looked at him and looked at me and said, like, you know, you really are no good, you know, and all that. And my mother, like, you know, I thought I was going to be rewarded or something, but instead of that, I was just, I guess, put down or whatever. I don't, that's the wording I'd use today. I wouldn't know what I was called then, but I felt like really ashamed, and I left. And after that, it was hard for my father to communicate with me, and it was hard for me to ever communicate with him again. So I left the house at that age, and I was off running through the streets of New York, and I started drinking in the schoolyards, drinking wine, about 15 years old at that age, around that time. Breaking windows, getting in trouble. Guys around me were getting in trouble. They were going to jail a lot. I wasn't at that time. By the time I was 18, there was guys that I grew up with that had already done 3 years in the reformatory or the youth house. And I was still out there, but I was running with them. I had turned 18, and I was 19 days turning 18. What that meant at that time was that I got a draft card. It was okay to get a draft card in those days. It was like a rite of passage. You were growing up. You were allowed to drink in bars at that time, buy alcohol. I was already drinking in bars. They're pretty lenient in certain areas of the city where if you had the money, you could drink and you could buy liquor. It wasn't never a problem or anything like that. But at that time, I just turned 18. I was 19 days into my 18th year. We were drinking in a park. It was a big, wild, drunken party. The cops were called. I got into a fight with them. We all did. I was locked up for felonious assault on a police officer. And right there and then, that was to continue for the rest of my life, practically, until I got to Alcoholics Anonymous. I was locked up, and I met other guys in jail that were kind of the same bent of mind that I was, and started to travel to different boroughs and different neighborhoods in New York. And to regress a little bit, when I went to school, I went to Lower East Side of Manhattan. I went down 2nd Avenue and 2nd Street. It's in the Yiddish Theater District, and Moskowitz and Lukowitz was on one corner, and on the opposite corner, on the downtown side of the street, was Social Court. And in this court was where they used to, there was a lot of, it was right near the Bowery, about two blocks off the Bowery. And they used to round up a lot of the drunks and take them to this place and process them through there. I remember they brought us over from the school that I was going to over to look at the drunks in the cages, you know, and all of that. And I felt something for them right away, for people in cages, you know. Little was I to know that years later I was going to wind up in a cage myself. Well, maybe I did know, who knows. Anyway, these guys, the first time I got in, really started looking at derelicts, I guess. I couldn't really call them bombs or alcoholics because there was alcoholics all over the borough. There was alcoholics on Park Avenue too, but these guys were really the unwashed and the disheveled and it was a weird sight to see at that time. They were all colors, all sizes, all shapes, mostly older guys at that time. And we were young, wise-ass kids in high school. We were having French and Latin. And youths or freshmen and sophomores, as they are, with a little bit of knowledge, they think they know everything. They would throw some words at these guys and let them know how smart they were and how better they were than this guy standing there with no shoes in the dead of winter asking for a cigarette. And they would say something to him, and the guy would turn back and read like a page in Latin out of the newspaper or French. It was the first time that I was to realize that there was a lot behind these guys. There was a story behind them. Later on, I was to be sentenced to 6 months in Hearts Island for mischief and fighting. And I was to be at the other end of the social court when they got rounded up in the summertime and taken to Hearts Island, which is an island up there near City Island in the Bronx, near the end of the Bronx. And at that time it was the workhouse. So they would come in and be sentenced to 60, 90, 30 days, whatever it was. And you would see them come in all beat up. Well, the life had really beat them up. And I'd see them leave in 60 days and 90 days. And my God, what a difference in people. I mean, you don't realize the change in them. Or you do notice the change in them. I guess people who are working downtown in this town, they see the difference in people once they get cleaned up. And then you have to learn a little bit of the history of the people behind the beards and the dirt. A lot of them were retired commanders from the Navy. There was a few guys that always stick in my mind. This one little jolly guy, he was a retired commander from the Navy. Another guy, a few of them were retired cops from New York City, retired firemen. One guy was a doctor. His family had grown and moved away, and he had just been hell-bent for alcohol, and he drank himself down to the Bowery. Or up to the Bowery, whichever way you want to look at it. So then you would see that there was a history behind them. A lot of them were getting their retirement checks sent to the workhouse, and at that time I really couldn't understand it. I didn't know anything about the disease of alcoholism. I didn't know anything about the progressiveness of alcoholism. I learned all that here. What happened was I was going in and out of jails as a youth in my 18, 19, 20. I finally got sent away for 5 years up to a reformatory, Elmira Reformatory in upstate New York. I got in trouble while I was in there with a guard. I had a bad attitude towards authority, which we all do, but I guess I wanted to commit suicide, but I didn't have the guts to do it. I wanted you to do it for me. So I was a tormentor and an attempter. And I had a lot of rebellion inside of me, which we all do. I'm not, I don't want to sound as if I was something different than I belong here. Anyway, what happened? I got sent up to Dannemora State Prison. It's a prison near the Canadian border. It was called Little Siberia at that time because the roads were closed 8 months out of the year. And right next door to it was the, for the criminally insane. And it was really, I don't know if all the criminally insane are in there or out here. But anyway, it was a kind of a last stop. And they figured once you got there, you were... they could do what they want with you, really. I only stayed in that place for 4 years. I remember when I was released that day, and I remember taking a ride back down to New York City, and I remember reporting to my first parole officer down on Gold Street, it's down near Wall Street. And I also remember going into a bar on 3rd Avenue and having a gin and tonic, and another gin and tonic, and another gin and tonic, and another gin and tonic, and I forgot the 4 years I had just completed in that prison. It was summer in the city, I had money in my pocket, I didn't care, I was home, I breathed it in the air, and I was off and running. 6 months to the day, practically, I was arrested and sent back for a robbery, 2 shootings, and a violation of my parole. And through the grace of God, I could never figure out why they violated me. Through the grace of God, which I didn't understand at that time, and I didn't have a God in my life at that time, I was only received another sentence of an additional 5 years. I was very fortunate at that time. When I had come out, I was kind of looking pretty healthy and everything, and when I went back in, I had met people that I knew from my own neighborhood when I was locked up in the tombs in New York City, and they didn't recognize me. These were guys that I had grown up with. So I didn't realize, I didn't know about the progressiveness of this disease until I got here, but in hindsight I have evidence of it in my life. So I was back in prison, back into Sing Sing, got in trouble again over there with another guards, was sent from Sing Sing up to Attica, was in Attica prison. And at this time I started to notice little coincidences in my life that were going on. all for the good. I remember I was in Attica when that riot took place, and I can remember we were in a mess hall, and I used to work in the mess halls a lot. You had more freedom and you had access to food. And I remember the day that we were about 60 of us, we were going to be taken back to the block, and the guard that was taking us back, he dressed in white too, but he had a blue shirt, but sometimes in the group you couldn't distinguish him from us. So the lieutenant had told him that when he's running us back to the block to make sure he wore a hat. So this particular day, he went to the gate, to open the gate to let us out, and he turned the key, bam, and he says, "Oh, I don't have my hat," and he turned the key back, blap. And usually from the pressure of 60 or so guys standing there saying, "Come on, you don't need your hat, just take us around the corner to the block, everything's okay, don't worry about it, come on," he usually gave in to that, but this day he didn't. By the time he went back to the kitchen to get his hat, and by the time he walked out, that riot had started. They were shooting right in the hallway right there, and the tear gas had come in. So when I say a coincidence, something like that, just a turn of a key, I could have been dead in it, and my mind was in it anyway. I was full of hate, and I was full of anger. And I didn't like you or anybody else that was connected with any kind of authority, and most of all, I didn't have any respect for myself. So that was like the first thing that kind of, because of a turnkey, I could have been, probably would have been, I would have been right in it the way my mind was working at the time. People that I had known from other prisons were in it. One of my friends or so-called friends, buddy, comrade, he had punched the lieutenant in the mouth that had started that whole thing. So that thing there, that took place. The place was shut down for 3 or 4 months. We were locked in a cell. Another time when I was put into, isolation, a strip cell, I was in there for 3 months, and I used to have this one guard. He used to come down every morning, whenever he was on, and you weren't allowed to smoke in there, and you would put on half rations, and there was no, you had to get off your mattress at 6 in the morning and fold it up and put it in the corner, and you couldn't get back on it till at night. and it was those terrazzo floors, and you only had socks on and shorts. And he would come down, he'd call me to the bars, and he'd say, "How you doing today?" And I'd say, "Great." And he'd blow smoke in my face. And I looked at him with hatred, because I knew what he was doing, that I could do it and he couldn't, and that if the situation was reversed, he couldn't stand up to it. And I was kind of, that's how I did a lot of my time, under those, under that fixation in my mind that I could do it, that I was going through something, that I was better than, that even though I was there, I could do it, I could do it. And it was all built on hate. So what happened is, when I got the after the Attica thing, we got shipped down to Greenhaven State Prison, and I got released from Greenhaven. I went back to the neighborhood again, and the same thing happened, only this time it took a year before I got put back in again. I was drinking, I was really completely out of control this time. Talk about the progressiveness of disease, from a kid starting to drink at 15 in the schoolyard. Now, after being away for another 4.5 years, I came out, just in a short time, I was back to where I was when I first started, at the end. And I was running through the streets then as a lunatic. I also had used an awful lot of drugs when I was going through what I was going through. I fell in with a lot of drug dealers, and I started using drugs, and I also started selling drugs. But I was one of those guys that had the bridge between the guys that were drinking, the gamblers and the drinkers and the drug users. And I could more or less go in and out of both groups. Anyway, at this one particular year that I was out on the street, friends of mine had owned discos in New York at that time, and they owned bars, and I was welcome in most of those places. And just that, what happened to them and what happened to me, I became a real lunatic drinker. They never knew when the bullet was in the chamber, when I was going to go off. I could drink 6-7 nights in a row. I could be happy, falling down, laughing, goofing, having a good time, and maybe one night I could have 2 or 3 drinks and some kind of craziness would pop up in my head, and I would be hell-bent on really hurting somebody, or taking out something that happened 3 months earlier, or talking about what somebody did 5 years before, or remembering somebody when I was a kid in the streets, what they did. I mean, it was real craziness. Anyway, I stayed out for a year. I became a lonely, solitary drinker then. They were in bars, but I would sit in the parking lot and drink wine. I would go to a liquor store and buy pints of wine and sit in the car and drink it, smoke pot, and fantasize. Then I'd walk through the streets of New York 4 or 5 o'clock in the morning, talking to myself, fantasizing, thinking about things that weren't happening, that were never going to happen, that never did happen. And I was just heading back to prison. That's where I was heading. And I was put back in for, I got a lot of breaks in my life, I really did, but it was all necessary. And what happened is I was put back in, and I stayed in for another 2 years, and I came out. And when I came out this time, more things started to intercede in my life. I fell in with another bunch of people, and we were involved in a lot of mayhem, I guess, to put it politely. And I was with them, and we had just come back from Brooklyn this one particular day, and we walked into this place where I was staying at that time, and I was very rarely there, and the phone rang, and I picked it up, and it was a brother of a friend that I knew. He was a younger guy in the neighborhood when I was growing up, and I met them in a mutual friend's bar, and we used to see each other alone. His brother called me up, and I just said, "Listen, I can't talk to you now. We had just come back from Brooklyn. We had drugs, and we were doing a lot of other stuff." And I says, "Call me back tomorrow at this time. I'll be here." And that was, I never knew where I was going to be in the next 5 minutes, if I was going to be any place, if I was going to be alive, if I was going to be on the streets, where I was going to be. Next day, at that same time, I happened to be there. The phone rang, and it was this guy. And he happened to be in Texas at the time. And he said to me, "Why don't you come down to Texas? Go to the airport tomorrow, and there'll be a plane ticket there for you." So I said, yeah, okay. This was in the afternoon, and like in hours, your whole life could change. Somebody could come up in a car and have another idea, and you'd go here, you'd go there. But so whatever happened is I did. I did go to the airport the next day, and I did get on the plane. I did land in Houston. And my God, I mean, we stayed all night in the airport drinking drunk, you know, laughing, falling down, talking crazy about what happened to the neighbor. And then I forgot where I was. I didn't even know I was in Texas. I thought I was going to go home. I thought, "I'm going to leave now. and I was going to go outside and get a cab, you know, and go back to New York, but there was no cabs running that night at Houston Airport. So I wound up staying down there for a while, and that was the beginning. It wasn't the beginning of the end. It was the beginning of this journey. And I got smashed out down there because I was out of my environment. And down there, they lock you up for public intoxication. They lock you up for having an open beer. They lock you up for looking crazy. And so I got locked up. I mean, I got locked up a lot. Quite a few times. But it was interesting how this whole thing was taking place for me, and I didn't realize it, that I'd have all kinds of oddball jobs, you know. One time I was working on a boat on the Mississippi River going in the Intercoastal Canal, Louisiana, and there was another guy stuck on a sandbar, and we went over and pulled him off the sandbar, another tug, and this one guy goes downstairs into the cabin, and he comes up with like a shopping bag full of pot, and here we are over there in some sandbar, I don't know where the hell it is, smoking pot, and talking, and I'm fantasizing, thinking I'm back in the neighborhood. So anyway, that happened, and I would get off the boat, and I'd go to the VFW, because that's where you could buy mixed drinks. So you had beer bars down there, and you had to bring your own liquor, or they only sold beer, or I didn't understand it. But anyway, I went to VFW, and they had mixed drinks there, and I drank and drank and drank, and I'd walk out, and I'd be walking back to some place I was staying near Highway 3 or something, near Texas City, and God, where would the sheriff be, you know? And I'd be locked up again for public intoxication. And I'd have money in my pocket, you know. And I couldn't believe they were locking me up for public intoxication. I thought it was a joke. That, I mean, where I came from, if the cops caught you drinking and you had a drink in the car, they thought you were good guys because you weren't using drugs. And if you had a six-pack, they took half of it. If you had two, they took one. Or sometimes they'd left you one. And it was... And if they started locking up people in New York City for public intoxication, I think they'd have to put bars around the whole borough. But I don't know what it's like today, thank God. Anyway, here I am in Texas getting locked up every time I walk in the bar and every time I walk out. Every time I got paid, I have money in my pocket. They take me to jail. They tell me a fine. I pay the fine. 4 hours later, they let me out. Then I got a car. Then they'd lock me up with the car. They wouldn't give me a DWI. They just have the car towed away. And then I'd have to pay to get the car towed out and pay to let me get towed out. And it was always that. And each little time that's kept happening, the fine kept going up and the money kept going down. And there was eventually something was going to have to give out. And eventually it did. The money did and my tongue gave out. I got into a bed. Argument, one of these Texas Rangers, not Texas Ranger, a state trooper or something, I don't know, and some other guy, and I got hurt a little bit, you know. I laid on the floor of needless to say, right? Anyway, I laid on the floor of the cell for a while, and thank God for all of that. You know, I thought that was the worst thing in my life that happened at the time, and I was being treated unfairly and all of this and circumstances. And if the light was red and if the light was green, my past is my biggest asset today. My past keeps me here. It's a miracle that I'm able to stand here tonight clean and sober. I mean, that's what it did for me, so it's necessary. It's all necessary. Anyway, then I got let out down there after so long. I don't know what I did. I was there 2 years, and I think I spent maybe 14 months of it locked up, or it seemed that way. I don't know. I never even thought I was going to get out of Texas alive. That was a miracle for me. Thank God for Texas. In fact, if everything works out all right, I'm going to go back to Austin the 25th and run a race down there. So that's interesting for me, too, to be able to go back. Anyway, I had a brother living out here, and there were more things going on in my life. I had a brother that lived out here, and he sent me some money to come out here. I drank that money up, and I had met some people in Texas there. You always meet people that are nice to you, no matter where you go. You know, you always meet people that are there for you. And I did. I always have been fortunate in my life. I've always landed on my feet. And what happened was I got put on a bus in Texas. In Houston, and I was coming here to L.A., and I got sober on the bus. I woke up someplace in some, I don't know where, you know, and you know how that feeling is when you wake up. And I didn't have any money to eat, and I didn't have any money for nothing, you know. I didn't have, I was just there. And people would get up, they'd go into these bus stops, and they'd get up, and they'd order food, and they'd walk away, and I would sit down, and I'd eat their food. And that started to, like, get on my mind, saying, like, you know, well, before that, back to Texas, when I was working a little bit up near Conroe, Texas, outside of it, on some kind of a construction job with a subcontractor putting on roofs. I had like a few dollars in my pocket, and come lunchtime, and I'd want to eat, but I'd only have a few dollars in my pocket, and I wanted to get a six pack before I take drink in the car to get home so I can get some more money and drink the wine or the gin that was in the house. And I wouldn't buy lunch, and I'd be starving or hungry anyway, and I'd walk around and they'd blow the whistle for guys to go back to work, and they'd throw their brown paper bags on the side, and I'd go in and I'd sneak a brown paper bag and open it up and eat a piece of a half-eaten sandwich, you know. And this is a guy, like when I was growing up in New York, I had, well, they might have been illegal aspirations, but they were aspirations anyway. I wanted to, I had my own heroes growing up, you know, and they were dock bosses in Manhattan on the North River, and they were big numbers runners, and they were interesting guys for me, and I liked their style. And that's just the way it happened, I guess. And so I wound up here, coming across, eating the food off people's table. I get up to things. So, you know, little by little, I was becoming the person that I didn't want to become, or the person that you kind of despise in your head. You can talk about hitting the bottom, and the bottom for me is not a physical bottom. You know, you can live on the bottom and not even know you're on the bottom. Where the hell is the bottom? The bottom for me was in my head. Things got so low, or whatever happened, I was reaching a point in my life that was so, like, I was, even to me, it was starting to get so despicable. Going to jail to me wasn't a big deal. Guys that I knew in my neighborhood, that was like kind of a way of life. I couldn't understand it at that time. Now I can, and looking back in hindsight, I guess any kind of attention, negative attention is as good as positive attention. As long as you're getting attention, you crave it or you want it or whatever it is, I don't know. I don't understand it, but like they say, more will be revealed, and that's the way it is for me today. Anyway, I got out here to, coming across on a Greyhound bus, I arrived here at LAX. LAX, I'm flying now, but anyway, I got maybe, that's great, huh? The magic bus ride. That's great. Anyway, downtown, at the Greyhound bus station. Then my brother was there. Man, we grew up in a house, but we were like a house of strangers, you know, we really don't know each other. And that's just the way it is. I don't think anything's wrong with it or anything's right with it. It's just the way it's unfolded in this trip. And we kind of passed each other. He didn't recognize me, and I didn't really recognize him. I seen him once or twice. He used to come to see me sometimes. Well, I'd be in prison, and he'd be coming into New York on his way to Europe or going to some other place, you know, and I'd see him, and hello, how are you? And we really didn't have anything to say. You know, it's hard to talk face-to-face when you really don't know anybody, and it's even harder to talk when you're sitting in a booth with a glass wall between you and you're trying to pretend everything's okay. Oh, no, it's fine. Everything's nice, you know. I'm playing tennis now, and everything's great. And it was, you know, and so I met him here, and I'm downtown, and I didn't know him, he didn't know me, but we just happened to have the same blood running through our veins. So I stayed at his house. He lived in Santa Monica. And this was in August of 78. And what happened is I was still a drinker and everything like that. And he, I guess, he had got a master's, I think, or something from SC. And he had knew those people like that that had education and were like professional people, lawyers, and into working in different forms of different city governments here, not particularly L.A., but the surrounding what would you say, municipalities, cities, I don't know, you know. Anyway, I fell in with them, you know, and I felt really awkward and out of it. Like, they would go to nice parties and drink wine, you know, California wine and everything like that. And I'd be drinking out of the bottle. Holy Christ. Could you put this glass in a paper bag so I could feel comfortable? But anyway, it was very uncomfortable. Most of my life, I've been very uncomfortable around people. I didn't know how to communicate with people. I didn't know how to say hello to people. I didn't know how to do anything with people. I was terrified of people. I didn't know that. So all of that, why I say all of that, is to bring me up to the point that I brought all of that with me into Alcoholics Anonymous. How I got to Alcoholics Anonymous is that one night I tried to really seriously hurt my brother after a drunken spree, walking in and kicking in the door of his house and trying to really hurt him. And I used to say I never hurt people around me, which is a lie. They always were the first wave to go. They were the easiest. They were the ones that went first. But I deluded myself with saying, oh no, I never hurt my friends, or oh no, I never hurt. At the end, there were no friends. There was no anybody. It was just me. And what happened is then I really kind of went on a rampage in the house. I was really too drunk to really do anything, but I kept falling down and throwing plants and falling over things. And he left. He left out. And he went to his friends, and his friend had called me the next day. His friend happens to be an attorney, real nice guy, happened to know myself. And he said to me, John, well, between the time I went to sleep that night, I didn't care. I says, I hell with it. I don't care if I go back or not. I don't really care anymore. It says, who cares? It's just I was at the end of the line. And by the time I went to sleep with that attitude, and by the time I woke up in the morning with a phone call from his friend, and he said, John, how you feeling? I says, I'm okay, you know. So he says, look, he says, I know what happened last night. Your brother's here with me now. And he says, listen, I just would like to give a suggestion to you. Do you think it's possible you might have a drinking problem? So my answer to all of that stuff years ago would have been, yeah, so what? But I didn't say that. My mind said that, but out of my mouth came, I might. So he said, why don't you see about maybe going to an alcoholic counselor or something? So I says, okay, maybe I will. But because of that, I did. I picked up the phone book, and I didn't know Santa Monica or any other thing, and I found a thing. Of course you're not going to go to AA. I didn't know about AA anyway. You'd think I would know about AA. I grew up in Manhattan. I mean, I went to school near the Bowery. They say in Attica the only thing that was going on while that whole riot was going on was an AA meeting. I read that in the grapevine. But I didn't know that when I was there. And I never heard them call out AA meeting or anything like that. When you want to hear, you hear. When you don't want to hear, you don't hear. And I didn't want to hear. There was no reason for me to hear. So what happened was, I did call. I can never remember this woman's name, but I know her face, and it doesn't really give her good justice or service, so maybe that's the way it is. It is anonymous. I don't know. But she had about 18 years at that time, and she was the right person for me because of her background. I was used to rough type people, street and all that, and, you know, in the bars in New York and all that, and that type of woman also. And she had that kind of a background. And we were talking and laughing and joking, ha, 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 and you want a cigarette? Yeah, have a cup of coffee. She goes, come on, you want to go to a meeting with me? I said, yeah, okay, I would go any place at any time. I was dying for human friendship or comfort, and I didn't know that. And I went to my first AA meeting. And I didn't know. I don't remember it that well or anything like that. It was all new, you know, and I kept going back to it. And I guess the miracle of the whole program is not that I went to my first AA meeting, but that I came here tonight. Because I would go any place at any time at that time. I would try anything. I'd do anything. Who cared, you know, and so what? And I went to the AA meetings, and I kept going to the AA meetings, and I really had no other place to go. I heard that said so many times, but I couldn't say it myself until it came to the time when I really didn't have any other place to go. And what I didn't know at that time was sitting in the room. I used to go to that noon meeting over there every day in Culver City, and I had no money. I mentioned that, and my brother used to dole out a dollar a day for me, and I used to take it, and he let me know about it too, you know. And I would get on the bus and go to the meeting and all of that, and I didn't know, and that was the only thing I had to go. It was the only destination I knew where to go. I knew every day I had some place to go. I knew I was going to go to a meeting. I didn't know anything else that was going on there, but I knew there was people there, and it was okay. I wasn't talking to anybody, but they were okay, and I was just sitting there. I didn't really know if they were okay or not. I didn't really care. Anyway, what happened was I got over there, and I used to sit along the corner, along the wall, and little by little you get to see people, you get to say hello to people, you see the same people, and then I remember times when we'd say the Lord's Prayer, And I just would hold hands. I didn't say the prayer at that time. I was brought up in a religious background, but I didn't say it because I didn't believe in it. I didn't want to say things I didn't believe in. I was tired of saying things by rote. So what happened is my hands would be so sweaty, I'd feel so uncomfortable, I was embarrassed, I didn't have money to put in a basket, I thought that you had to, it reminded me of the church. I mean, then thank God for these guys that get up out of nowhere and they say, if you're here in your first 30 days, don't put no money in the basket because you can't buy sobriety. I said, right. So my big problems at that time was to put money in the basket, buy cigarettes, or take the bus home. And sometimes I would walk home, sometimes I put money in the basket, or sometimes I buy cigarettes. I smoked at that time. But little by little, just by sitting around, I don't know if I got this program by osmosis or what, you hear about the steps, and you hear people talking about the steps, and do the steps, and all of that, and they were on the wall, and I couldn't understand them. I didn't want to ask anybody about them. I had no idea. It took me a long time to say hello to people. Hello, what do you mean by that? And, you know, I didn't know how much I was dying for human friendship and human companionship. And just sitting in a room with a room full of people was really a lot for me. It was very comfortable, and that was it. After a meeting, I used to run. You know, somebody say, would you like coffee? I didn't want to go because I didn't have money to pay for it. And I didn't want to say, oh, I don't have any money, you know, as if now we know. Now I know. It doesn't matter. Money or no money. You know, it was just the gift of friendship that I didn't know anything about. I didn't come from that environment where you become friendly with people. You know, you can't go in those places and expect somebody to come up to you and say hello to you. You have to be suspicious, or I was suspicious of everybody and everything. I didn't like me, I didn't like you. I did a lot of my time on hate. The program for me today, and then the book, it says, I love the book. I mean, I hear people say, I read the book and it wasn't the... I don't know. I loved every word of the book. I loved the wording of it. Attraction rather than promotion. I love those words, the way it was put together. And the purpose of this big book is to introduce you to a power greater than yourself. Now, I used to go down and watch the sunset in Palisades Park a lot. And one day I saw the sun go down, and I say, that's it. Whatever power is doing that, help me stay sober today. And that's my higher power. Whatever power is doing that, people would say, well, it's the revolutions, it's this, it's that, and the axis has been... I don't understand that. I don't know anything about that, but I know no human power is putting that up and down, so I said, that's it. So I was very fortunate that I got a hold of that right away. And then when I was also fortunate, I started running when I was locked up. I used to run around the yard when I was locked up, and there was times I could only see the sky and the walls. And I started running in sobriety again, and I've been blessed with that too. And I've had great runs along the beach at low tide, and I mean, I have gone down there, and this book talks about being rocketed into the fourth dimension. I have no idea what that is, but I have been running on the beach down there. And the sun is shining, it's low tide, there's dolphins out there, the mountains are in my face, the sun is in the sky, and I'm looking around and I'm saying, wow, how did I get here from that cell with the guy blowing smoke in my face? How did I stand here tonight at this podium from a wise-ass kid in Anchor State Prison who was just one turn of the key away from getting his head blown off or getting killed or hurting somebody else? I'm made in AA. AA put me together. AA taught me how to dress. AA taught me how to work. AA taught me how to earn money. AA taught me how to say hello to people. If anything, AA should be stamped on my forehead. Made in AA. I'm a true product. I'm really a true product of AA, and there's nothing that AA could ask of me that I couldn't possibly not do in return for the gift that was been given to me. The only thing I can say is that it does work, and I'm proof of it tonight, that you can stay clean and sober no matter what kind of baggage you come in here with. You feel like you belong, you're either too low, too high, or too something. But it does work, and thank you very much.